Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Grok Radio. The following broadcast is made possible by the friends and partners of CYI Worldwide Ministries and Grok Radio. And the views expressed in this program and by our guests may not necessarily reflect those of CYI Worldwide Ministries or its staff. And now, enjoy the show.
You stand on the shore of the ocean watching the tide come in. You sense the call of the sea beckoning to take you in further. You step forward little by little, not knowing what to expect, but expecting more. You keep going as the ocean calls you to enter in to deeper waters.
Hello everyone and welcome to the Deeper Waters podcast. Today's show is being pre-recorded due to some scheduling conflicts and such. And so we will not be taking your calls today, but I hope you'll be enjoying today's show because, you know, on the show I try to keep you all informed with the best in scholarship. And I also like to introduce you to those in the field who might not be as prominent, but I think have something to say that should be worth listening to, who are very educated on the positions that they defend, who are stellar examples of what of how one should be behaving in the apologetics community and such. But unfortunately, this week I got in a bind. I got my friend Eric Chabot to come on to talk about Judaism and Christianity. Hello, Eric. Are you there?
I sure am, Nick. Good to be here.
Now, you've got a Master's in Religious Studies from SES, and you're the Director of Ratio Christi at Ohio State University. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay. So, we're going to be talking today about Jesus and Judaism, kind of since we're preparing for Christmas, asking questions relating to the Incarnation in Judaism. And this is a field you've done a lot of work in, working with Michael Brown as well. And how did you get to this point? Tell us your faith journey and what got you interested in Jewish apologetics.
Sure. Well, I was raised in a mainline Protestant denomination here in Columbus, Ohio, and actually the community I grew up in was predominantly Jewish. I think all my friends, almost 70% of my friends were Jewish in high school. And the church I went to growing up, even though I was like a nominal Christian, was surrounded by two or three synagogues. So I just had a lot of experience in Jewish culture. And then in my mid-20s, when I really started asking about what I believed, I actually found out about a congregation locally that had Jewish people that believed in Jesus in the congregation. Those are Messianic Jews. They go by that name today. And I just started attending services, started listening to the sermons, and then God was really getting hold of me speaking through the sermons, and that's when I really came to faith and really became a believer, a follower of Jesus. And it was really right away that God made it clear that I had a calling into Jewish ministry, at least Jewish missions. I always had a heart for Jewish people. I knew the culture. And then just for the last 20 years or so, I've been, immersed in that kind of studying. I've taught a lot of classes on it. We have a really good adult education institute at our congregation. We have scholars come in like Craig Evans and Craig Keener and some of these other guys that are doing stellar scholarship. And so we that's our approach. We do have a lot of teaching on the relationship between Judaism and Christianity. And for me personally, I really developed an interest in the apologetic stuff because I did do a lot of outreach and still do missionary work to Jewish people on the campus. I actually work for a Jewish mission, even though I volunteer to do Ratio Christi as part of that. And so I've had a lot of experience talking to Jewish people about these topics, and I just think it's a fascinating topic to go into because really our faith was birthed in Judaism. A lot of the things we believe come right out of Judaism. So it's a nice connection to have.
Yeah. Dialoguing with people who are Jewish, it's really a different animal from dialoguing with so many people today, isn't it?
Yes. I can say, I think we both know, we've had some experience in it. If you start talking to Jewish people that are really Orthodox, which is really a small minority within the Jewish community these days in the States, but still they can be really tough, and we know that they have their their beliefs and they stick to them, and they're very defensive. And we know that they also have some misconceptions about what we believe, as happens in religious dialogue. And they generally do not budge an inch on a lot of issues, especially when we talk about the incarnation, which we'll be talking about today. It's a tough one, right? So they can be challenging. So, yeah, but it's exciting, you know, because in a way, you know, it's kind of like when I'm talking to Jewish people who are really Orthodox or really committed to their beliefs, I kind of view it like Paul. You read in the New Testament, you know, he says in Romans 9, verses 1 through 5, he's broken over his countrymen's rejection, is, you know, the Jewish people's rejection of their Messiah. They have the covenants, they have the promises, they have everything. But Paul, you know, the Holy Spirit's bearing witness, and he's, I'm just broken over their rejection, you know. You just have to kind of have the heart of Paul when you're trying to do it. I try to empathize, you know, kind of what Paul was going through, you know, and Jesus too, of course.
Yeah, but we should explain, when you say it's tough, some of my listeners out there could be thinking, well, I'll just go and I'll give the minimal facts, explain the resurrection, give a classical argument for the existence of God. How much different can it be? But it really is different even with that, isn't it?
Right. Well, the problem is that, you see, when we do Christian apologetics, and for yourself, myself, and even your father-in-law, Mike Lacona, let's face it, we love the resurrection. We love to use that as one of our main apologetic arguments, and we've studied it, we've taught it, we've debated it. And with Jewish people, it's interesting that when it comes to Orthodox Judaism, at least, they're the ones that are really looking, still looking for the coming of the Messiah, and they have a vested interest in it. But the resurrection really isn't a huge messianic qualification for them. And so when you start arguing that Jesus rose from the dead, and, hey, he has to be the Messiah because he rose from the dead, well, they're, a lot of them will just say, well, I don't really care. That's not a messianic qualification, because within Rabbinic Judaism, which, you know, was formed after 70 AD, after the temple was destroyed, they've kind of formed their own messianic qualifications, and a lot of it has been a reaction to early Christianity, and they don't really view the Messiah's rising from the dead as a qualification. Their view of the Messiah is that he's supposed to build a temple. He's definitely not divine. He's supposed to gather Jewish people back to the land, as we read in some of those passages in Jeremiah and Ezekiel. And he's supposed to probably bring some sort of world peace, like we read in Isaiah 11. There's supposed to be a massive change in the world. But there's really no explicit need for a Messiah to rise from the dead. And that's where we run into some problems with them. So we got to go backwards with them and go over, you know, what are the messianic expectations in the history of Judaism? Is there only two or three? You know, are they supposed to build the temple and gather Jewish people back to the land and make world peace? Or are there other expectations, like in Second Temple Judaism, which you and I have kind of studied a lot, or, you know, some other time, you know, various times, or the Dead Sea, you know, like the Dead Sea Scroll community, what were their messianic expectations? So I just try to take Jewish people over the wide course, you know, of messianism and try to broaden it out, not just stick with Rabbinic Judaism and their expectations. And that's about all we can do. But the other thing we need to point out with Jewish people, and I try to do, is the reason they don't see the resurrection as a huge qualification is, first of all, they don't think the New Covenant's happened. You know, we talk about the resurrection having to, it's directly linked to the New Covenant, where, of course, the Spirit of God has to be poured out, he has to come into our lives, and we have the law of God written in our hearts, like Ezekiel and Jeremiah talks about. Well, without a resurrection, that isn't going to happen. And then secondly, we view sin differently, because a lot of Jewish people don't view the fall of Adam, you know, the original sin issue, as something that's detrimental to them. They view sin more as based on the Torah, where if you sin against God, you know, you break one of the commandments, I mean, you need to be forgiven. But they don't really view like sin as a nature, like we have this sin nature where we need to be regenerated, we need the new spirit living in us. And that's kind of weird, we know, because we know in Ezekiel and Jeremiah that God says very clearly he's going to do that. He's going to put his spirit within Jewish people, and that will happen. So the question is, can we get them to see a resurrection is needed for that? And that's what I try to talk to them about.
You know, one thing I was thinking about was Pincus Lapides, who's a New Testament scholar. He actually does affirm that Jesus rose from the dead, but he doesn't believe Jesus was the Messiah.
That's right. Exactly right. He got a lot of flack for that, actually, when he came out with that book on that topic. But you're absolutely right. He does not believe Jesus is a Messiah for the Jews. He thinks God brought Jesus in the world to open the door to the nations, because, of course, the Messiah is supposed to do that, right? I mean, that's what we read in the Old Testament. He's supposed to be a light to the nations as well as to the Jews, of course, a light to the nations. So that's what he believed, and he did some debates with Walter Kaiser and some other people, and he did do some good work in Jewish-Christian relations. So interesting guy, but, yeah, he did believe that.
Okay, well, let's get to some more fundamental points here. When we talk about Jewish apologetics, the incarnation is a big stumbling block a lot of times. This idea that God becomes a man. And to be fair, that should be a stumbling block for most anyone. It should be something that totally blows our minds. I tell people that if you were a Jew or a Gentile reading John 1 and you got to verse 14 and said the Word became flesh, you would have probably just dropped the book right at that point in stunned silence and thought, did I just read what I think I just read? Now, when we talk about this, though, we've got a clue from a Jewish perspective, the Old Testament. Does the Old Testament really say anything about the incarnation or about Messiah being deity or anything of that sort?
Well, you know, I think that's where we have to ask, does it say it, does it teach explicitly, you know, that the Messiah is going to be deity, or that does it explicitly teach the incarnation? I would say it's more implicit, because I think that what we see throughout the Bible, it is a history of progressive revelation where God is revealing more of himself over different periods of time. So by the time we get to the New Testament, it's obviously much more explicit, you know, that Jesus, you know, Jesus' deity is there, the triune nature of God and the Messiah being divine. So there are some hints of it in the Old Testament. It's just not as clear. So I would say that, you know, you can really approach the issue of the deity of the Messiah, the incarnation in the Old Testament, a few different ways. I mean, you could talk about the nature of the Godhead. You could start with, like, Genesis 1:26, where God says, "Let us make man in our image according to our likeness." And then we kind of notice there, like, there's like a plural possessive pronoun with "our," and then we start to talk about, well, what does that mean? Does that mean God is, you know, is he a Trinity? Does he have a complex nature? What's he talking about there? Well, some Jewish people think that passage is referring to God speaking to a group of angels, that he's talking about, "Let us make man in our image," that it's referring to a group of angels. Now, it sounds kind of bizarre, but they know that we think it's triune. It's speaking of, you know, some sort of Trinity passage there, so that's what they come up with. But there's real problems with that, because obviously, you know, that there wasn't any group of angelic angels there doing any creating, right? We know God alone is the creator. He doesn't need any help from angels to create, right? I mean, why would he consult angels to create? And so that's a real stretch. Rashi believed that. He believed about that it was about angels. He was a very well-known Jewish medieval commentator that Jewish people listened to. And we also could look at other passages that talk about the nature of the Godhead, like Isaiah 6:8, where, you know, it says, "Who will go for us? Whom shall we send?" We see that God refers himself in like a plural pronoun there. And then there's another passage, like in Isaiah 48:16, it says, "Come near to me, hear this, I've not spoken in secret from the beginning, from the time it was, there I am now, the Lord and his Spirit has sent me." So, you know, you kind of have the Spirit going out from God. And so I think one approach is certainly to talk about the passages about the nature of the Godhead. You're just talking about also, like, God is one. You know, what does that mean when you say, you know, God is one? Does it mean, you know, there's two different words. We talk about the word echad and the word yachid. And the problem is that we get into this issue of one that, you know, a lot of Jewish people think that it's interesting, you know, that God, they sometimes appeal to the yachid issue, because when we say God is a, you know, one, like an echad, that means that means obviously that God certainly can be a complex unity, but not one in like an absolute sense. So, you know, when you're talking about when it says here, like in Genesis 2:24, it says, "For this cause a man shall leave his father and mother, cleave to his wife, and the two shall be one flesh," where that's the word echad being used there. So it's used as like a complex unity, but not one in an absolute sense. So sometimes they appeal to like the yachid issue, where it talks about, like, in Genesis 22:2, it says, "Take now your son, your only son." But see, in that sense, one is used as like only one in the solitary absolute near oneness. And that's where like Maimonides comes to play in this issue, because Maimonides has had a huge influence on Judaism. He was a great medieval thinker. We know he was had a lot of philosophical influence as well. But he has really, when he wrote down his 13 principles of what to believe in Judaism, the 13 principles of faith, one thing he did do is he appealed to the issue of Yahid. He said basically, now he's kind of changed it, and he says here, like in one of his principles, he says, I believe with perfect faith that the Creator, blessed be his name, is a unity, and that there is no unity in any manner like unto his, and he alone is our God, who was and is and will be. So while it's written in Hebrew, the word Mamad that he uses for God's unity there is Yahid. So right away, he's changing it. You know, prior to Maimonides, God was always expressed as like an Echad. And then what you kind of have the polemical conflict in the medieval period, you see how they kind of change it around. They start using the word Yahid, and they start saying, well, God, you know, isn't always an Echad. So that's one way to look at it. I know it sounds a little complex there, but one of the ways I approach it also is to talk about the messianic names for the Messiah in the Old Testament. Like when we talk about whether Jesus is a Messiah, you know, there aren't a lot of passages that say, hey, here's what the Messiah is supposed to do, A, B, C, D, and E, and it says the word Messiah, right? It doesn't really say that. The word Messiah means anointed, right? What, someone who's anointed to do something. So we have to appeal to these messianic names, such as like Son of Man, or the word Scepter, or Shiloh, like in Genesis 49, 8 through 12, where it speaks of like a ruler who will come out of Judah. He'll have like a worldwide dominion. He'll have a worldwide reign. And then, you know, the Daniel 7 passage that Jesus appeals to, Daniel 7, 13 to 14, talks about how the Son of Man will, all the nations will like worship him, right? There's kind of like this universal worship of this figure. So we have, you know, you have to look at some of those titles. That's another, the names for the Messiah. You can look at those and talk about whether that's just like an earthly figure, or whether this is really speaking of like a divine figure of some sort. It is pretty clear that can't just be an earthly Messiah. You know, there's something more divine about him to have kind of this worldwide reign, because we know only God is the one who gets worship and has sort of that worldwide reign over the world. A third way is to look at theophanies in the Old Testament. That's a real popular approach among Christian apologists, like Ron Rhodes, I think, wrote a book on that. I think there's some challenges with that because, like, of course, you know, theophanies isn't like a biblical term. It's like a term used to talk about the manifestations of God in the Old Testament, where you saw this figure like appears to Abraham in Genesis 18, in Exodus 3. There's the angel of the Lord in Exodus 23. Those are interesting passages, but I don't think we can say for sure that that is really like Jesus in the Old Testament. Those are Jesus. I know a lot of Christians appeal to that, but I think that's a bit of a challenge. I think exegetically it's got some challenges, and I think what we want to just do is show some epistemic humility, because when we think about it, think about this. If that's really Jesus in the Old Testament for sure, would the incarnation really be that unique then when he comes, if he's already appeared in the Old Testament? I mean, you know, the incarnation is something that's supposed to be totally unique, right? I mean, the coming of Jesus and the New Testament. So I think that those theophanies are interesting, they're relevant, and there's some sort of divine figure, like an angelic-like figure, but I'm not so sure I'm prepared to say that that is, you know, Jesus for sure. You know, I think there's been some work on that. So I just think that what we see is some hints, certainly of the divine aspect of the Messiah, the Davidic king. We read in Isaiah 9 verses, you know, the passage there about Wonderful Counselor, Prince of Peace. There's another figure there that is going to have an international reign. It can't be Hezekiah, which some of the Jews refer to. But I just think it's pretty clear it becomes more explicit in the New Testament. So like I said, I think there's some hints of it in the Old Testament, but there's some different ways we can approach it. We just got to be very careful.
Okay. Well, we're going to go ahead and take a little bit of an early break, because I don't think there's enough time again for another question. When we come back, we will discuss this kind of topic more. I'm Nick Peters. This is the Deeper Waters Podcast. My guest is Eric Chabot. We're talking about Jesus in Judaism. We'll be back after this break.
You there?
Join Unituber and Army Girl for Christ as they discuss spiritual warfare, spiritual preparedness, the end times, life issues, and personal and spiritual growth. That's www.truthradionet.com. Truthradionet.com.
And we're back with the Deeper Waters podcast. My guest is Eric Chabot today. We're talking about Jesus and Judaism. Now, Eric, you used this term progressive revelation when you were addressing this last question I had. Can you explain that some?
Yeah. I think in Christian theology, it's pretty clear we talk about this a lot. It just basically means that we're talking about progressive revelation. We're talking about how God does not reveal everything at once. There's different periods of time where is the Bible, if we read it from left to right, from Genesis going to Revelation, we're talking about God's revealing more of himself, his nature, his plans for humanity over the course of history. And then, of course, we believe with the coming of the Messiah, the coming of Jesus, like we read in Hebrews chapter 1, it says, in these last days, God has spoken in his Son, right? We believe he is the ultimate revelation of God. So part of the problem with Jewish people is that, you know, from experience, we taught them about this, is they don't really hold the progressive revelation. They believe the Torah, the giving of the Torah to Moses, was the ultimate revelation that God gave. He gave the Torah, and that is binding to them, and they have a hard time believing, you know, that God's going to give a greater revelation later on, right? And so it can be kind of tricky to talk to them about that. So you sometimes have to just stay inside the Torah and try to pull out some nuggets that, you know, maybe God has spoken there about, you know, this incarnation issue. Now, I do think we know there are passages in Deuteronomy where God promises a new covenant. He talks about how God will give them eyes to see and ears to hear. He talks about to Moses towards the end of his life that he's going to do this thing. You know, it's coming. The new covenant's coming, right? And so we almost, you know, kind of have to take the Torah and kind of point them to Jeremiah and Ezekiel then and say, look, this is what we're talking about. And then we believe, of course, Jesus is tied in with the new covenant. But progressive revelation is really tricky sometimes, and we're talking to them about that.
Yeah, and this one's tricky not just with Jews, but with other non-Christians and such. You expect everything to be spared out immediately right at the beginning.
Right.
We think about like the issue of slavery. We say, well, God should have started off without having to have any system out there that we don't like right now. He should have started immediately teaching them about equality and democracy and all this other stuff.
Right, right. Yeah, it's everywhere. That's right. Progressive revelation is so important. And remember, like, the issue of the incarnation, you know, Deuteronomy 4, you know, this is a passage that Jews appeal to where it says, you know, that, you know, God says, you heard the sounds of the words, you saw no form, there's only a voice, and then he kind of tells them about idolatry. He says, and the Lord commanded me at that time to teach you statutes and ordinances. He says, since you saw no form on that day, the Lord spoke to you, beware that you act corruptly by making yourself a graven image, right, in any form of a figure, like the likeness of male or female, like the likeness of any beast that is on the earth, et cetera, et cetera. I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but the point is that that's a passage they would use to say, look, that's idolatry, and, you know, you Christians, you know, you have Jesus, and you worship him. You know, that is an idol. You're taking a man and making him into, you know, the likeness of God. Well, of course, you know, we have to kind of come up for a response to that, and then we have to ask, has God revealed himself? You know, is that really what God's saying, that he can't ever take on any physical form there? You know, is that what that passage is saying explicitly? Because what does he say to Moses, you know, later, you know, in Exodus 33, 20 to 23, he talks about how, you know, Moses may not see him and live, right? But we know that he talks about, you shall see my back and my face shall not be seen. Like Moses saw something there, you know, something of God. He just couldn't see him, his face directly, you know, obviously. So the question becomes, you know, does that passage really prohibit God from taking any form? You know, that issue of idolatry, and that's where the debate is with Jews.
Well, you said that the Jews, they don't believe in progressive revelation, but if we went back and we looked at, say, ancient Jews or Jews in the medieval period, like Maimonides or Rashi, did any of them say anything that would indicate progressive revelation was going on in what we call the Old Testament?
Yeah, well, not really. Here's the thing. It's interesting. As far as those two, Maimonides, they both believe in the coming of the Messiah. I mean, Maimonides definitely believes in the coming of the Messiah, and he believes that, you know, when the Messiah comes, he'll gather all the exiles, he'll restore the temple, et cetera, like the prophets talk about. So the question becomes, when we're talking to Jews, what do we mean when we say progressive revelation? Are we saying, are Jews saying, look, the Torah is it, and that stops there, there's no revelation outside Torah? Well, that can't be true, because obviously you got the prophets, you got the rest of the Old Testament. And so the question is, we have to press them on, you know, when you're talking about progressive revelation, I mean, are you talking about the entire Old Testament? Are you talking about just the Torah? They'd have to say the whole Old Testament to be faithful. I mean, it's obviously revelation is progressive throughout after the Torah, right? I mean, the Torah talks about things that happen in the prophets, like, you know, Moses talks about the coming new covenant, which is talked about in Jeremiah and Ezekiel. So that have to be a form of progressive revelation. But Rashi doesn't say, I don't think, a whole lot about it, but Maimonides does believe in the prophets. You know, the prophets talk about the coming of the Messiah, but their messianic qualifications are. And then in rabbinical literature at the end of the days, like the Messiah comes, it's interesting, you can read it, they say there's a change in the Torah. The Torah will really have, will be changed. There will be a change in the Torah in the messianic age. And that's very similar to what you and I believe has happened with Jesus, of course, that with his coming, we are living in the messianic age. Now, it hasn't finished yet. It hasn't, you know, we still have another part of it at the end when he comes back. But there has been a change in the Torah from what the Torah was, you know, how the Torah functions today in the life of a Christian, right? We don't, you know, we get the, Christians use the word law a lot. I like to prefer the word Torah. But, you know, so we, in a way, you know, we can talk to them about that issue as well. So.
Well, let's try and be clear on something else also, because we use the word Torah here. Sometimes when it's used, it can refer to the whole of the Old Testament entirely, and sometimes it refers just to the Pentateuch, the five books of Moses, traditionally. How are you using the term? I'm gathering you're using the Pentateuch, but...
I'm referring just to the Pentateuch. When I say Torah, I mean teaching. It means teaching instruction. It just means the whole first five books of the Bible. I don't know any. I don't know most Jews that use it outside of that, because you talk about the prophets, and then you have the writings. You know, you have the other parts of the Old Testament broken down. But I'm just strictly appealing to like the first five books. So that's the way I, you know, when I refer to it. I hope I didn't. Maybe I should clarify that. So anyway,
Most Jews today would accept the prophets, the Psalms, and the historical books and such. We don't really have many Sadducees running around today, do we?
Well, you know, I tell you what, here's what we've discovered. The latest Pew survey that came out a couple months ago said that over 60% of American Jews say you don't need to believe in God to be Jewish. So that tells me, and from my personal experience as well, that many Jews do not have a high regard for the Old Testament, period. You know, it's just mostly cultural Judaism that they're practicing. But when you deal with Orthodox Jews, they certainly believe the entire Old Testament is inspired, and some of you even believe Moses, you know, received the Torah audibly from God, like God dictated it to him, you know, and he wrote it down. I mean, they go to that far as well, you know, that far as well. Some of them, I'm saying some really, you know, very Orthodox Jews believe that, but many mainline or liberal Jews that don't practice, you know, do not believe the Old Testament, any of it's really authoritative, any of it. But yeah, most Orthodox Jews recognize the entire Old Testament, but they do have a strong connection mostly to the Torah. The Torah seems to have a lot more prominence than the rest of the Old Testament, as far as like the prophets and other parts. It's very interesting, but it's just the way it is. And they also believe it's called the Oral Torah. They believe that Moses received other revelation outside the written revelation. That Oral Torah became what we have with the Talmud today and the rabbinical writings that they read outside of the Bible. So there is other literature they read, of course.
Would that be related to the traditions that the Pharisees were passing on as well? Because the Pharisees, if I'm correct, held strongly to an Oral Torah as well.
Yeah, that's similar. That's right, yes. That's when Jesus is talking about that with them. That was The Oral Torah is very authoritative in Judaism. And yes, there were some things that was going on at that time period with Jesus, even though that they hadn't been written down completely and codified, you know, the rabbinical writings like the Mishnah and the Talmud, they came a little later, as far as written down. But there were some teachings, obviously, that the Pharisees were appealing to that that Jesus knew about that were outside of the written word. So it's interesting. It's an interesting topic, that's for sure.
Now, we talked some about the incarnation. Now, that's seen as idolatry. And then when we get to the Trinity, that gets even more complex. Since I'm guessing that's probably seen as polytheism to the Jews. And to be specific, it's also seen as polytheism to a lot of atheists I interact with.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. Atheists and Jews and Muslims still all seem to have the same views. Yeah, they view the Trinity and they view the deity of Jesus as linked together, but they view those a lot of times are tied in with Catholicism. They kind of view it like the Catholic Church made up these doctrines much later. They're pagan. They were formed, you know, in the creeds, 4th century, you know, much later on. And so they don't have an early understanding of how these doctrines came to be, because you know and I know they started right away, you know, in Paul's teachings and the early writings of the New Testament that the deity of Messiah and the triune nature of God is there very early on, pre-70 AD. But they view it as something much later that was created, you know, by the church, and it mixed in with Greek thinking, you know, the kind of the Greek thinking or the paganism, et cetera. So you kind of have to back them up a little bit if they're interested. So.
Yeah. So what can we do when we're accused of idolatry and polytheism? What are the steps that you take?
Well, I think you have to go back to the issue. If you're going to stick with the Old Testament, we have to go back to the issue of the nature of the Godhead, and we have to ask whether God is, in his nature alone, is he a complex unity? Is he, you know, a trinity? Is God's nature triune? We have to go through some of those passages, like I talked about with the word echad, you know, we talk about God as one, and the words yachid, and kind of differentiate and see if there's any basis there for the nature of the Godhead being triune, like I talked about a little bit ago. The second thing we have to point out is that, which can be a little tricky, is that we certainly have good evidence that nowhere in the New Testament are any of the authors saying they're committing idolatry. None of them thought that they were idol worshippers in the least bit, right? Paul says in 1 Corinthians 8:6, he's addressing a polytheistic crowd. He says there's many gods and many lords, but there's one God and one Lord, the Lord Jesus Christ, right? He's kind of adhering to monotheism, but yet he's saying Jesus is now part of that monotheistic context, but he's not giving into any kind of polytheistic teaching or any kind of paganism. And so you have other writings, you know, in Paul's letters, certainly that adhere to God being one. I mean, think about Paul. I mean, we don't know exactly, you know, we know somewhat about Paul's background, his education, everything, but you really, from what we read in the New Testament, do you get any idea that Paul was unaware of what polytheism was or paganism? I mean, he almost was fighting against it. You know, you read about it in some of the letters that he writes. I mean, they were aware of Greek polytheism and some of these other things. So it seems to me that we can certainly appeal to that. You know, the New Testament authors are not idolaters at all. But once again, with the Jews, they don't really read the New Testament, so they may have a lot of straw man arguments. You know, they may say, well, they're a bunch of idol worshippers. Well, you know, why don't you go read the New Testament? I mean, that's just the opposite. But if we're going to stick in the Old Testament, we're just going to have to go back to the nature of the Godhead. We have to talk about the deity of Messiah and whether, you know, the Messiah, those passages I talked about with, like, Son of Man and some of those other passages to see if, you know, the Messiah is divine. So that's the way I would approach it. You can stick with some of the Old Testament stuff, but give evidence New Testament authors were not idol worshippers. There's also Jewish categories for Jesus. And you talk about how he's the wisdom of God. Talk about the Shekinah, you know, he's the glory of God. There's Jewish categories that can be used to describe Jesus' deity as well. But I really think that what we have to get to, the bottom line, is that a lot of Jews have just been told over and over, there's no way God can take on human form. So we've got a huge obstacle to fight against us So
now, you talked about the passage in 1 Corinthians 8 where Paul includes Jesus in what Richard Bauckham and others call the divine identity. I'm wondering if
right.
you could comment some on that, because I think Richard Bauckham has even said the earliest Christology is the highest Christology.
Right. Well, what we're talking about with Richard's work is he's talking about, we used to have a couple categories and we studied, you know, the Christology stuff in the New Testament. We had what was called an ontological Christology and a functional Christology. We still have them. They're still there. But the ontological Christology is from that word ontology. We talk about natures, essences, metaphysics. And, you know, scholars used to just try to talk about the nature of Jesus, like what is he? Is he, you know, how do we work out the incarnation with the nature issue, the metaphysics issue? And then some scholars came along later and said, you know, for Jews, they don't really care that much about ontology. They're more interested in what the Messiah does, his actions. And so they kind of talked about the functional aspect, you know, what Jesus did that would cause a Jew to believe he was deity, you know, his actions. And so what Bauckham did, he came along and said, well, you know, those two categories are not really that helpful. We need to move on to another paradigm. And he started this divine identity thing. And so what he believes is that really what we see in Paul's letters and some of the writings is that, you know, Jesus is kind of placed in this role attributed to God and Jewish expectations. So he is given, like, the attributes that are distinctly reserved for God alone, but they're in Jewish categories or understood in a Jewish manner. So we talk about, you know, how God is the sole creator of all things, right? All Jews in Second Temple period knew God as the sole creator of all things. They knew he was the only being deserved of being worshipped. He was a sole ruler of all things. So you read Paul's writings like Philippians 3 and Ephesians 1. You read, of course, that, you know, Jesus participates. It's like Jesus participates in God's rule over everything. You read in some other letters like Colossians 1 that Jesus is a creator. He's the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. All things are created through him. And then you read in other passages like Philippians 2 how Jesus is worthy of worship. Of course, that, you know, so you see these things with Jesus being identified with the God of Israel. He takes on the identity of the God of Israel. Else he's identified, I should say, with the God of Israel. So that's what Bauckham has worked on in that area, and it's really good stuff, that's for sure.
And it's also been worked on by Larry Hurtado and others with
right.
the idea that this view of Jesus as fully divine didn't just evolve over time or grow from a little legend or something, that right at the start, bam, they believed Jesus was divine immediately after the resurrection.
Well, that's right. I mean, the earliest records we have for the divinity of Jesus are not the Gospels, they're Paul's letters. And we know that even though Paul wrote them somewhere between 48 and 60, he was probably, you know, martyred around 65 or so, 65 A.D., that those letters, you know, it's in those letters that you have a really early, you know, divine view of Jesus. And even the material he received in those letters were received earlier. So the death pushes the deity of Christ back, you know, closer to even to the death and resurrection of Jesus in 33 A.D. So it isn't something that evolved way, way, way later on. I mean, we have the 1 Corinthians 8 passage I just mentioned. You know, that's from the letter 1 Corinthians that's written in 55 A.D., but we know Paul received that material even prior to that. And so that's really interesting. Then you have passages like Romans 1, you know, verse 1 through 5 that talks about the resurrection of Jesus. Jesus is son of David. He's been resurrected. That's an early letter as well, Romans, which obviously we can attribute to Paul writing it. So you have this early view of the deity of Jesus, and that you just got to ask what the best explanation is for that, right? We have to say it does, you know, people do need to give us an explanation why a bunch of Second Temple Jews who knew what polytheism, paganism were, why they would suddenly, you know, view one of their crucified fellow countrymen who was crucified on an execution stake, you know, that they would start to view him in a deified way. And that's something that's very significant, and we don't want to just skate over that. So it deserves an explanation of some kind.
Well, I've got one other comment I'd like to make on that, but we're going to take a quick break first. I'm Nick Peters of the Deeper Waters Podcast. My guest is Eric Chabot. We're talking about Jesus in Judaism. We'll be back after this break.
It's here, the official Grok Radio mobile app. Listen to your favorite Grok Radio programs on your iPhone, iPad, iPod, Kindle Fire, Android smartphone, and tablet. The best thing is, it's absolutely free. Download it now from the iTunes or Google Play App Store, or get a link at our website, cyiworldwide.com. Grok Radio, Christian radio that doesn't suck.
I am Nick Peters, and this is the Deeper Waters Podcast, seeking to bring you the very best in Christian apologetics. And I'd like to remind everyone that today's show is pre-recorded. As you're listening to this, if it's on a Saturday afternoon, I'm not actually at my studio, my virtual studio, as it were, at the time. I'm probably doing something else at the moment, but this show is being pre-recorded, so we can work with Eric's schedule better. And so we won't be taking your calls today, so don't try. And we were talking about the earliest Christology being the highest one, and just going back to the oral tradition, one passage that came to my mind immediately is also in 1 Corinthians, and that's 16:22, where it says, Anathema Maranatha, which is an Aramaic saying, for those who don't believe in the Lord Jesus, they're accursed, and then come, Lord Jesus. And what's important about this is Paul doesn't have to translate it. That his audience is familiar with the saying. The saying is referring to Jesus as Lord and including a divine curse on his enemies as well, which shows this is an oral tradition right off that has Jesus fully deified.
That's right. That's right, Nick. Actually, that's an excellent passage. I agree 100%. That's one of the earliest, another early record we have. So, like I said, I think we have to ask, you know, what caused these Jews to view Jesus in this light. You know, is it the resurrection and the experiences the disciples had with him before the resurrection, after? Of course, Paul wasn't one of those early disciples. So, you know, or is it just some sort of, you know, thing they just came up with, some sort of made-up story? I don't know why Second Temple Jews would want to make up a deified Messiah. You know how atheists always say to us, and even some Jews, they say, well, the New Testament's biased. What do you have outside the New Testament? You know, give me some records outside the New Testament.
Oh,
the contemporary authors, right? Well, I mean, you know, if they're so biased and so untrustworthy, and they're just out to write propaganda literature to make converts or make believers into those that read it, why in the world would they make up, you know, a story of a deified Messiah? I mean, it just doesn't make any sense for them to do that.
Even more than that, and a deified, crucified Messiah.
Right, right, that's right. And so, you know, we just have to kind of push them on that topic that, you know, it's like Greg Boyd and Paul Eddy say, I may be pronouncing their maybe Eddie or Edie, because I haven't met him, but they say in their book, The Jesus Legend, you know, they say there's a massive paradigm shift that took place in Second Temple Judaism, that you see a bunch of Second Temple Jews worshiping a man alongside their God who's a creator. And they said that calls, you know, for an explanation. There's no other messianic figure in the history of Judaism. And by the way, not every messianic figure was not called the Messiah. Just because someone leads a revolt against the Romans, that doesn't make them into the Messiah. But the point is that there's no other messianic figure that led a massive paradigm shift of Jews, you know, believing he's a deity and actually worshiping him in some capacity, whether, you know, it's prayer or whether it's calling him Lord or whatever it is, and there's some debate on what kind of worship. But the point is the devotional practice changes. And for Jews, devotional practice is very important, like Hurtado talks about. And so we need to, you know, understand that this is very significant out of all the messianic figures we have, you know, that this is a massive paradigm shift.
You know, something that we should also be clear on is that the references you're using are coming from Paul, mainly, and there are a lot of people caught in old biblical scholarship that's since been refuted that we're still say, where Paul was the one who invented Christianity, Paul did all this. He brought about all these changes. So let's give a response to that as well.
Yeah, well, there's always been that view, and it's interesting that even in Judaism, you know, Paul is not viewed with a is in a good light. I mean, they kind of view Paul as kind of like the heretic. Jews have kind of come to accept Jesus in a little more positive light. There's been some scholarship done that says, you know, we got to fit Jesus into Judaism. Okay, we'll own him. You know, he's got a place in our history, you know, but we don't believe he's a Messiah or deity or anything. But, you know, he taught some Jewish teachings. You know, he has a role there. But when it comes to Paul, you know, they kind of like, ooh, you know, Paul's the one who broke away and started this movement. But I don't think if you look at what Paul taught and the way Paul was, I don't really see any strong evidence that he started Christianity, per se. I mean, you know, he broke away and started this brand new religion. I mean, if anything, we know he affirms his Jewish identity. He says, I'm a Jew in Acts 22:3. He says, I am a Pharisee in Acts 23:6. He says, I am a prisoner for the sake of the hope of Israel in Acts 28:20. He didn't say, I was a Pharisee, I was a Jew. It doesn't, we really even can't even really say for sure when Paul came to faith, you know, he like received, you know, he switched religions. I mean, it was more of a, I look at more, Paul had a call. Like, it was like, from the Hebrew word repent, it's called shuv. It means to turn back or return to God. I look at like he returned back to the God he'd always known, the God of Israel. But, of course, Jesus was the one who helped him turn back. He repented and turned back. But I don't see anything where he, like, converted to a whole new religion and started a whole new religion. I do believe he certainly had to rethink his whole theology, and there was a lot of changes he made, and there was a lot of things that are new. I'm not saying there's nothing new, but I see Christianity as becoming more of a kind of like a more of a predominant religion, you know, much later on, I mean, in history. I mean, a little later on, I should say, not much later, but when the Gentiles, more Gentiles are coming in the church, and the church is kind of losing its Jewish core. There's always a small Jewish remnant, but then we kind of have an official Christianity much later, per se. I mean, there's a lot of debate about this when we have an official Christianity in scholarship. You know, was it pre-70 AD, the parting of the ways, you know, to happen after 70 AD when the temple was destroyed? I mean, there's some good work on this. James Dunn's done some work on it, some other scholars. Of course, Bart Ehrman, we know, has debates about this. So I would say, though, it's really tough to say that Paul broke away, like, from the teachings of Jesus and started a whole new religion. If anything, his teachings are compatible with Jesus. I don't think he did anything in opposition to Jesus from what we see with, you know, some of the work that's been done in scholarship.
And with Paul's account of being a Jew, we can look at his own words, especially in Philippians 3, where he gives his pedigree. And
right.
When you talk about him having a call, I thought immediately of Galatians 1, where he tries to write out the whole chapter, and he's using language that's supposed to be parallel to Jeremiah, being a prophet
right.
to the nations.
Right. Yeah, it's the same kind of language, right. And we know that, you know, it seems like when we read the Galatians 1 passage that, you know, I always like to say to skeptics, you know, some people point out the 1 Corinthians 15:3-8 and then the Galatians 1, they say, well, you know, it kind of sounds like maybe there's some sort of contradiction there, because we know in Galatians 1 it talks about he only received the gospel from Jesus, or Jesus alone, right? He had a revelatory encounter. But
right.
in 1 Corinthians 15, he receives the gospel from his other apostles. He received the creed from Peter in Galatia or whatever. So which is it? You know, it sounds like a contradiction. But I always look at it like, you know, the way I see it, in through, you know, doing my own studies, is that in Galatians 1, Paul really received, like, the essence of the gospel through that revelatory encounter, but then he received the form or the doctrinal content of the gospel in 1 Corinthians 15. So it's not really necessarily a contradiction. He's using the same word received in both passages, same Hebrew, same word there. So.
What we could say, then, perhaps, is that Paul received the knowledge of who Jesus is when it was revealed to him, but to put it
right.
in a doctrinal form, he got that from the apostles.
Exactly. I think that's a perfect, it's nuanced very well, exactly. You couldn't have said any better.
Now,
that's right.
You start talking about New Testament scholarship as well, and something we should point out is that there are Jews who are involved in New Testament scholarship. Most explicitly, I'm thinking of Geza Vermes, who recently passed away. He was a Catholic and became a Jew, instead, and we've always spoken about Pincus Lapide. So Jews do have a place in the study of a historical Jesus, don't they?
Yeah, there's always been Jews that have done work in that area. There's another one recently, Amy Jill Levine. She teaches at Vanderbilt. She's Orthodox, I believe an Orthodox Jew, and she's come out with some other scholars called a Jewish New Testament commentary. She's done a lot of work on the Gospels, and what she wants to do is actually she wants to get Jews to start to read the New Testament. She wants them to actually read the Gospels and start learning the history of the New Testament and how it's a Jewish period, why Jesus needs to be understood instead of just kind of ignoring it. And so she's doing a lot of work in that area. She doesn't believe Jesus is a Messiah or anything, but she's doing a lot of work in that area to try to change that view within Judaism itself. So that's interesting, yeah. So we've always had some Jewish scholars, like Geza, you mentioned, and Pincus Lapid and David Flusser was mm-hmm. another one. He lived in Israel. He passed away a ways back. He did a lot of work on Jesus and Judaism. There's been some other
also.
Names. What's that?
I think Jacob Neusner.
Yeah, Jacob Neusner. He's a really, really prolific scholar. He's written a lot of books, but yeah, he's done a lot of work on some of the relationships between the New Testament and Rabbinic Judaism. So he's another one. And keep in mind, none of these people believe Jesus is divine. He wrote a book called A Rabbi Talks to Jesus. None of these guys think that Jesus is divine or think he's a Messiah, but they think that Jesus is worthy of study. They don't think he should just be ignored. And that's unfortunate because in the history of Judaism, a lot of Jews are told not to read the New Testament because they think it's anti-Semitic. They think that Jesus is the main reason or one of the main causes of anti-Semitism in the history of the Jewish people. And granted, you and I, you know, I know one of your colleagues has written a new book, you know, on whether Hitler a Christian or not. And, you know, the question becomes, you know, are Jews really looking into the evidence? Have they really examined that to see if it has any historical basis to it? And, you know, a lot of there has been anti-Semitism in the church, that's for sure. I mean, we can historically
document. And we have to condemn it.
Yeah, we have to condemn it. And there has been misreadings of the New Testament. It's true that when Jesus debates with the Pharisees, that some people later on in church history viewed those polemical exchanges as Jesus hating the Pharisees. He's condemning them. You know, and they've taken those passages and saying, well, you know, we should condemn the Jews and they're doomed, you know, they've rejected Jesus. And so we need to obviously do the good exegesis and the proper hermeneutics and show what was really going on there between Jesus and the Pharisees. Like Luke Timothy Johnson's done this. He's done some scholarship on how polemics worked in the Gospel of John. But it's really hard sometimes to get Jews just to read the Gospels and just take Jesus, you know, on his own terms and just kind of learn and be willing to be open to it. They've been told it's so anti-Semitic. And that's tragic, you know, but we need to work on that. So, and there has been books have been written on it, for sure. Mm-hmm. Anyway, there's another guy named David, I think it's, I may be mispronouncing it, Kloffinger. I think he does a lot of intelligent design work. He's a scholar in intelligent design. He's a Jewish guy who's written a book called Why the Jews Rejected Jesus. And he, you know, he's explored some of that stuff as well. He's, but he does believe in God for sure. He's just not on page about the Jesus thing. So, you know, it's an interesting topic.
And we can say that there are Jews. We talk with many Jews who are just opposed to anything Jesus. But there are several Jews who would also say, well, we could say Jesus was a prophet. Jesus was a great teacher. We just don't believe he was Messiah or that he was divine, or he died and rose again.
Right, that's right. Yeah, they don't, it goes back to Messianic expectations, and the traditional Messianic expectation today, based on Rabbinic Judaism, is that the Messiah is supposed to build the temple, he's supposed to gather the Jewish people back to the land, he's supposed to just be an earthly king, not a divine Davidic king, and there's really, and also there's some passages like in Isaiah 11, to speak about worldwide peace, where there'll be like a universal rule. The Messianic Age will, you know, when the Messianic Age comes, it's going to, you know, the history is going to look different. The world will look different. Israel will be at peace. So they don't see that, and so that shows us that Jews think very pragmatically, that they, you know, if the Messiah comes, he's got to do something that makes a big pragmatic difference in the world. Now, you and I know that we could make arguments about Jesus that he has made a pragmatic difference, but for them, they're just reading kind of the traditional view of Messiah. and they don't see anything about him. Like we said, he talked about rising from the dead and some of those other things. So it's tricky going through that with them. They do believe he's like a prophet or just another failed Messiah, but not divine. And remember this, Jewish identity is defined mostly today by rejecting Jesus. That's one of the main ways they define themselves. If you talk to them, they say, I'm a Jew. I don't believe in Jesus, right? So, yeah, that's one of the ways they already define their Jewish identity. So it's just what they've been told, and it's a big stumbling block.
Well, one term that you've also used today that we definitely need to talk about, and I think this is going to be a big portion to talk about, something that people need to learn a lot about, is Second Temple Judaism. Now, before we get into Second Temple Judaism, what went on it, we need to know, what is Second Temple Judaism, and what makes it so different?
Well, we're talking about Second Temple Judaism. We're talking about that period in Jewish history that is a religion of Judaism during the Second Temple period. It's between the Second Temple in Jerusalem, like in 515 BCE, and then it was just destroyed by the Romans in 70 CE. So we're talking about that period, that Jesus was a part of, and that's something that we talk about the history of Judaism. Jewish people say, okay, we talk about rabbinic Judaism that starts after 70 AD when the rabbis came together and they had to rethink Judaism, had to come up with a whole new way of atonement because the temple's destroyed, and then we had the formation of the Mishnah and the Talmud and these writings. So you have like the rabbinical Judaism, right? That's what we have today. It's an outgrowth of the Pharisees. The Pharisaical Judaism kind of, leaned its, eventually evolved into rabbinic Judaism. Then you talk about intertestamental Judaism. You have the period between the Old and New Testament. And then you have, of course, we don't really have a Judaism in the Torah. Like, there's an official Judaism, like, even in the Old Testament, per se. Like, they have, like, people walk around saying, we have, like, Judaism started back in the Torah. Well, not really a formative kind of Judaism. I mean, yes, you have the formation of Jewish people, but we talk about different periods of Judaism. You think of, intertestamental Judaism, you think of Second Temple Judaism, you think of rabbinical Judaism, you think of maybe, then Judaism later on after that, the formation, of Reform Judaism, Conservative Judaism, Orthodox Judaism. So Second Temple Judaism is the one that we, we're really getting into, because that has a lot to do with the period of Jesus and the formation of some of these Jewish sects that he was around at that time, and Paul as well.
There are some people I know of who are extremely conservative and seem to have a lot of doubts about what went on with Second Temple Judaism. It really was this period of unique thinking that went on in the time of Jews.
They have a lot of doubts. You mean about what? You mean like what happened with them, or?
Well, kind of the idea that there were these forms of interpretation of a Bible, such as Midrash and Pesher and all these other
things. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, you mean, yeah. I mean, you have some of the, that becomes relevant when we look at how the New Testament authors use Messianic prophecy, because let's face it, I mean, there's a lot of Messianic prophecies in the New Testament. A lot of them look like they're quoted. Some of them look like they're quoted out of context, maybe out of the Old Testament. And a lot of the Jews like to attack us on that. They say, well, how are the New Testament authors using these prophecies? And so that's why guys like Richard Longenecker and some of these other scholars have had to write books on these hermeneutical methods of the Old Testament, or of the prophecies. And one of, you just mentioned a few of them, like Pesher and the literal method and some of these other things that, they use. Because if we don't understand that, I mean, you could just read through the New Testament and think like, wow, like, I mean, how are they really using these prophecies? I mean, are they just kind of making them fit Jesus? Or, are they using, proper hermeneutics? And that can get really tricky. So, you kind of have like four ways, like the New Testament authors use the Old Testament, like you talked about the Pesher thing, but you have like a direct fulfillment where it's a predicted prophecy, it's direct fulfillment like the virgin birth, or, the quote about Jesus being born in Bethlehem, Matthew uses it, and then you have kind of like a typology that's used. You know, that's another method. And then you have kind of like a literal plus application where, like, Matthew quotes Jeremiah 31:15. You know, he uses the situation Jeremiah makes it, applies it to Matthew 2. And then you have the issue of a summation. You talked about Jesus being a Nazarene. That's an issue of summation. That's a method they use. So there's a lot of different methods they use, and that's very important. I don't have a lot of doubts about them. I know Jews have some questions, but we just need to be willing to show them that these are the hermeneutical methods a lot of Jews use at that time, just like the Dead Sea Scroll community. You know, they used a lot of different hermeneutical methods like Pesher and some of these other things. So very, very important for sure in understanding prophecy.
We're going to take a quick break. I'm Nick Peters. This is the Deeper Waters Podcast. My guest today is Eric Chabot. We're talking about Jesus and Judaism. We'll be back after this break.
Check out CYIWorldwide.com. CYIWorldwide.com, home of Grok Radio. Free music downloads, advice, prayer, and support. CYIWorldwide.com. Do you grok?
Are you tired of the same old corporate Christian music on the radio? Check out Music Surge on Grok Radio, playing Christian music that doesn't suck. Download episodes now at CYIWorldwide.com.
You're listening next week. Right now, we've got Eric Chabot. We're talking about Jesus and Judaism. But next week, if you're listening, we're going to have Anthony McCroy on. He's a visiting lecturer at the Wales Evangelical School of Theology and the London School of Theology. And we're going to be talking about Christmas traditions with him. Santa Claus, Christmas trees, things of that sort. And you'll want to be here and get to listen to that. It's going to be next week on the Deeper Waters Podcast. Now, right now I've got Eric Chabot here with me. We're talking about Jesus and Judaism. We just started talking about Second Temple Judaism. So what we need to discuss is the kind of ideas that were formed in there, such as the wisdom of God. This is a major one. What were the Jewish beliefs about the wisdom of God then, and how does Jesus fit in?
Yeah, well, the wisdom motif is very interesting because We talk about wisdom, you know, we can't just appeal to the Old Testament, but we talk about Israel's wisdom literature. You know, we talk about Proverbs, the book of Job, Ecclesiastes, and then we actually have to look at some of the other books outside the Old Testament, such as Sirach and the Wisdom of Solomon. Now, I know we as Protestants don't accept Sirach and the Wisdom of Solomon as part of our canon, but it's going to be really tough to say that there's no impact, that the New Testament authors such as Paul and, you know, some of the other authors didn't have access to these books and they weren't influenced by them at all. I mean, it's tough to say that's not a possibility. But the point is that we're talking about wisdom. We're talking about this figure of wisdom. It's not like a second of God, but wisdom's like it's really described not only as a personification of God, but as a separate person from God. So when you read like John 1, you know, 1, the 1:1-3, it says, in the beginning was the Word was with God, the Word was God. We talk about that passage there. It's talking about some sort of this issue of a figure, like an explanation for preexistence in Judaism, like there's this background for a Christology. So, like, we see wisdom like is seen with God at creation, like in Proverbs 8, verses 27 to 30. And then we read the same thing like the book of the Wisdom of Solomon. We read in Sirach the same motif where this figure is seen with God at creation, and then, of course, we believe Jesus is, you know, with God at creation, John 1:8. We see some things about wisdom, how God created the world by wisdom, like in the Wisdom of Solomon, chapter 7, verse 22. We read something similar in Proverbs 8:27. We, of course, believe God created the world by the Word, right? The Word was with God. That's similar to what John says. There's also a thing like in the Wisdom of Solomon, chapter 7. It talks about how wisdom is a pure animation of the glory of God. We also know that Jesus is referred to as a reflection of God's glory, the exact imprint of God's very being. We read in the book of Sirach how there's this invitation to draw near, bearing wisdom's yoke and learn. That's very similar to what Jesus talks about in Matthew 11. He talks about drawing near to him, right? Taking the yoke from him. And then there's this issue of whoever finds wisdom finds life. And then, of course, Jesus is the giver of life. And then if you reject wisdom, like in Proverbs 1 and 8, Jesus talks about people who reject him are lost as well. So whoever rejects wisdom is ruined. Whoever rejects Jesus is ruined. And this wisdom motif is kind of more talked about in Ben Witherington's book, Jesus the Sage. He wrote a book on that back in, I think, the early 90s, talking about how Jesus fulfills that role. It's kind of like the wisdom figure. Now, one last thing I just want to say about that. It's interesting that with the wisdom issue, that there are rabbis that say, I have the writings that say that when the Messiah comes, he'll be someone that's greater than Solomon. He'll be like a sage. He'll be greater than Solomon, right? Well, we know that Jesus says in Matthew 12, he says that one has come here that's greater than something greater than the wisdom of Solomon's here, right? So it's interesting that Jesus kind of fills that category that they're talking about. So wisdom's important. It's definitely a way they understood the deity of Messiah in the New Testament. I think it's definitely clear that that's there.
And since you mentioned Ben Witherington, I should point out to the listeners, if you might have missed last Saturday, Ben Witherington was with us for the last hour to talk about the birth narratives in the Gospels. It's a fascinating hour, so if you missed that, you need to go and listen to it. But when you talk about wisdom, I also like it when Jehovah's Witnesses come by and they want to take me to Proverbs 8 to try and make their case. And I can say, yep, I agree, that's talking about Jesus. Problem is, it makes my case much more than it makes yours.
Right, right. What do you say to them, Nick?
Well, what I point out is that God has always been with his wisdom. There's never been a time when wisdom was absent. It's not that God creates wisdom and then all of a sudden he's wise. He's the only wise, eternal God, and he's unchanging. And then I also like to make a little syllogism, because in 1 Corinthians 1 it says that Jesus is God's wisdom. So I say, well, God has always had his wisdom, and God's eternal, so I go this way. Jesus is God's wisdom. God's wisdom is eternal. Jesus is eternal. It's a
awesome.
Very difficult syllogism for them to get out of.
Right. No, that's very good. You know, the other word that, like I talked about before, a Jewish category for Jesus that I think is really important besides wisdom is the Shekinah, you know, that motif, you know, how that's like what we talk about, the visible presence of God, how he dwells upon people. Like we read about in the Old Testament how the glory of God would come to dwell, you know, like in the tabernacle or the temple, and you see like these manifestations of God in light, fire, cloud, or, you know, some of those things. And that is exactly really how I think the New Testament authors also understand who Jesus is. And because it's interesting, there's a tradition, the rabbis believed, actually it's very interesting, they would say for if two rabbis are studying the Torah together, they would say God's presence or his Shekinah would dwell upon them, right? Well, guess what Jesus says? Where two or three gathered in my name, I will be among them. I.
Matthew 18.
And who is he? Yeah, he is the glory of God, right? He is the Shekinah, the glory of God dwelling among them. Isn't that interesting? So
yeah.
I think that that's exactly the way John understands in John chapter 1, where he says, and the Word became flesh and dwelled among us. It's got that, you know, that view of, you know, God tabernacling upon his people, you know, where the Word of God became flesh and tabernacled upon his people. So I think that's an interesting motif. You know, that's something we need to look at Jesus' deity in that context as well.
Yeah, we can also look at how he not only saw himself as the embodiment of Torah, as you point out, and the embodiment of wisdom, but he would see himself as the embodiment of a temple, too, because when people came to him, he didn't say, go to a temple and get forgiveness. He'd say, go and show you're cleansed already, and he'd forgive them already. Right there, this thing, you don't need to go to a temple anymore. I'm right here. I'll do that for you.
That's right, and that's why he was accused of blasphemy. that's another reason why I don't understand the skeptic arguments about the bias and the making up, you know, materials in the New Testament, because making up the sayings of Jesus or whatever. Why, if you want to convince a bunch of Jews that he's a Messiah, why would you say he's a temple in person? I mean, that has got to be the most blasphemous claim you could possibly come up with. The temple was everything to the Jews. It you know, it was their social, it was the sociological center of their life. It was a religious and cultural center of their life. And then you had this Messiah figure walking around saying, guess what, I'm the temple in person, I will forgive you on the spot. I mean, that is so blasphemous. So that that really shows that, I think it's pretty clear that is what we call explicit, that Jesus thought he was, that's a claim to deity right there, you know, just saying that alone. And that is another way to explain his deity. Now, Jews won't accept that today, obviously. They think that that is still blasphemous, right? But for us, we know that Jesus certainly took on a whole new dimension when he made that claim. Very, very significant indeed.
It does get back to something I'd said at the start of the show, and the fact that Jesus's life was entirely radical. That, think of a word became flesh, would have stunned everyone. And really, the Orthodox Jews, who are the most antagonistic towards Jesus, they might also be the ones who are the closest to recognizing what his significance really is, rather than people who say, Jesus was a good teacher, good prophet, said some good things we should believe in, such, because you look at the New Testament and see what he said in the Gospels and say, yeah, do you think a good teacher of Torah would really say things like that?
That's right. That's absolutely right. Why would a good teacher make these kinds of blasphemous claims? And that's what we want to point out. I mean, you know, the old Lewis argument, Lord, lunatic, liar, I mean, as much as you still have to do some work today to make that argument work out, you know, we have to do some more tweaking with it than we used to, it's still got some validity to it, right? You know, Jesus would have to think to be completely insane to make these kinds of claims, these blasphemous claims. And so we have to press people on that and see, you know, if they say, well, look, if a Jewish person says, like just yesterday, I'll just say this, yesterday I was at lunch, I was sitting at Ohio State, I was working on some things, and these two Jewish students came up to me. I already knew them because I taught them before, but I sat down, talked with them for about an hour, and we were talking about some religious things, Judaism, Christianity, and things. And sure enough, they said, well, the Gospels were written way, way later, you know, 60, 70 years later, and, you know, we can't trust what they say about Jesus. And I still said, well, let me ask you this. I mean, even if they were written way later, I mean, even if they're written earlier or later, whether they're written 5 to 10 years or whatever, I mean, you're still not going to accept the claims of Jesus, right? He's the temple in person. I mean, you find that to be blasphemous, whether it's 5 to 10 years or 50 years later, right? And they were like, yeah, I guess you're right. So that's very interesting, you know, that they admitted that to me.
It seems that we've often gotten that area, kind of a secondhand skepticism, where people will throw out these claims that when the Gospels are written in session, they have really no way of verifying it, no argument they can make for it, other than maybe something like Bart Ehrman says so, or Richard Carrier says so, or something of that sort.
Right, that's exactly right. It just shows that everyone has their authorities they appeal to, and you know, for those two names, I mean, people appeal to them a lot. I think even, you know, Ehrman's even more utilized than Carrier, because Ehrman's certainly got more. He's got, obviously, he's written a ton of books, and he's very respected New Testament scholarship. I think Carrier's more respected by the, you know, the skeptical community. Of course, they threw Ehrman under the bus after he claimed that Jesus existed. But it seems that, yeah, I mean, they appeal to those guys a lot. That's why we as apologists, we really don't have any choice but to try to respond to these guys and come up with counterarguments, because they do impact a lot of people. You know, they did a lot of people to pay attention to these guys and what they're saying. You know that more than I do. So we have to be able to respond.
Yes, if I had a daughter for every single one of them who thinks that Carrier is the end all of New Testament scholarship, I would be a very wealthy man right now.
Right, right. Well, the good thing about Ehrman is that he definitely, you know, let's face it, we can agree with him on probably about maybe 60 to 70% of what he says. It's just the maybe other 40, we just can't, 30 to 40, we just have to part ways with. So he a lot of things, and I do respect a lot of his scholarship. He's done some good stuff. I mean, I have his New Testament introduction. I look at it, you know, he's got a good knowledge of early Christianity mm-hmm. history, and it's just his views of Jesus. And interesting about him, you know, he's another guy that says the deity of Jesus was made up much later, that none of the early Christians thought Jesus was God. He said that in his book, Jesus' Historical Argument. I have it right there. I wrote a blog post on it. And I wrote a response saying, sure enough, that doesn't match up with what Paul says. His writings are the earliest, and we know that he thought Jesus was deity. And so this issue of them not thinking Jesus was deity, I mean, is, and it was something that came along much later, it just doesn't, it just doesn't bear out in the New Testament. Doesn't you know, that's not what the New Testament teaches. So I don't know why he says that. Yeah.
We're going to get to have some fun in a few months, because Erman's going to have his latest book coming out on the deity of Jesus. So
right.
Via
right. We'll have our hands full with that one.
Oh, yeah.
So,
you know, when we get back... Go ahead.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
Well, I was assuming when we get back to the uniqueness of Jesus, I've often made this statement about the crucifixion of Christ, and that's that the crucifixion, based on the things Jesus was going around doing and saying, it was either the most righteous act of all that put to death the most wicked man of all, or it was the most wicked act of all that put to death the most righteous man of all. It's one of those two, based on the kinds of claims Jesus was making.
Right, and what we can kind of tie that in the topic maybe of how Jews view a suffering Messiah issue. Maybe we can kind of tie that in with that topic a little bit. Because I've done a lot of research on that. Yeah, we know now that Jesus' crucifixion was viewed as a God-cursed death. We see that in the New Testament. Paul talks about how it's a stumbling block to Jews in 1 Corinthians. We know the ramifications. I mean, you know, if you want to be a Jew and follow a God-cursed Messiah, and not to mention Paul talks about your identity is now in him and his death and resurrection, that your new identity is in him. I mean, that would be a huge stumbling block to a Jewish person. And we
it's
know
a stumbling
that,
block to anyone.
Yeah, and it's still a stumbling block today. And we know that in the history of Messianism, like when you have any kind of Messianic figure, that we know historically when they would die, you know, the movement would die out and the Jews would look for another figure to come to do what the Messiah is supposed to do. And so we do have an interesting case that we do see the movement carrying on, you know, moving forward beside, you know, despite the fact Jesus was crucified as a God-cursed criminal. But this issue of a suffering Messiah is interesting because, you know, a lot of Jews will say to me, well, you know, what they did in the Gospels is after Jesus died, they had to kind of adjust the prophecies and kind of make them fit Jesus' life, and so there was no case for a suffering Messiah, but they just kind of made it up. Well, you know, we can respond to that. I mean, first of all, yeah, sure they had to adjust their thinking. We read in the Gospels that Jesus said he was going to die, and they didn't understand it. They were confused. And we do see, of course, after he rose from the dead, it was more clear to them, right? It was pretty clear on the Emmaus Road in Luke 24 that, you know, that they did have a full understanding of Jesus' purpose and that he was going to die. But we don't really have any literature based on what I've seen in John Collins' work and some of the other work done, that we see a clear messianic expectation of a Messiah who's going to die. Now, I know Carrier's come out with some arguments on that, saying there was, and he's used it, you try to use that, there's a Wisdom of Solomon passage or something, but there's really nothing in the Dead Sea Scroll literature and some other cases of a clear expectation the Messiah is supposed to suffer and die. Even Isaiah 53, you know, the way it was read then, if they're reading the Septuagint, I mean, you know, the Greek Septuagint of the Old Testament, the translation of the Old Testament Greek, you know, there's still no case that we see that they were expecting it, you know, that they wanted him to suffer and die, that they made it up. If anything, you know, they had to make an adjustment in their thinking, but it wasn't something they created and just sort of made up to out of nowhere. I mean, you know, they just decided to, oh, we'll just make up a suffering Messiah, you know, to win our fellow countrymen. So, interesting topic.
It's not exactly the best sales pitch to have up there anyway. So, come to our Messiah. Yeah, he was crucified.
Right. That's a tough one.
And I just don't think people understood how crucifixion was viewed in the first century, how barbaric it really was, and how much of a stumbling block that would have been. The thing that strikes me is Paul's writings talking about in Romans how your identity is now in Jesus, you know, his death, his resurrection. And so you're talking about a Jewish person having to take their new identity in Jesus, like their whole identity is in him, right? His co-identity, crucifixion. So that's a huge, that's asking a lot for a Jew in Second Temple Judaism to do.
Yeah. When I talk with so many people, I say, well, of course he had to die if he was going to be resurrected. That's not really much of a thing. And I'd say, no, it's not that he died. He was crucified. That is crucial to point out.
Right, that's right. Absolutely. The crucifixion issue is very important. So I think that what it shows is that God, I think the problem we have sometimes is that, you know, we talked about this. I've talked about this with Michael Brown and talking about with Jewish people. Maybe we can talk a little bit about this now, talk about Messianic prophecy. You know, when we read those prophecies in the Old Testament, is that we can't really afford to do Messianic prophecy from a superficial perspective, as, you know, we do apologetics. We can't just say, there's 330 prophecies fulfilled in Jesus. When I was a new Christian, I read a lot of Christian apologetic books that just had this chart, you know, of the scriptures on the left and then the fulfillment on the right from the New Testament, and saying, look, here they are. There's 330 prophecies fulfilled in Jesus, you know, and you should just be so, it should be so clear, you know, that it's just that simple. Well, you know, as Michael Brown's pointed out and others, you know, you have to read those prophecies in context, and some of them maybe we're trying to get prophecies where there aren't prophecies, right? I mean, some of them aren't even prophecies. So we need to really be careful to do the right exegesis and understand the text and make sure that we, you know, understand what they're really saying, the original context, and then how they're fulfilled in the New Testament. And that's really critical we do Messianic prophecy, because there's been some really superficial treatments on that end in the past. I'm sure you've seen them yourself, right? So.
Oh, yes. Yes. And from that, before we get further into that, though, we need to take another quick break. I'm Nick Peters for Deeper Waters Podcast. My guest is Eric Chabot. We're talking about Jesus and Judaism. We'll be back after this break.
Hey, this is Minister Grock. Thanks for listening. Although Grock Radio is free, there are costs to upkeep the website, podcast, and purchase Bibles and materials for street ministry. And while we are happy to pay this ourselves out of pocket, we will gladly accept any gifts if you feel led to support the shows and our street ministry. You can send a gift or love offering through our website at cyiworldwide.com. Thanks for your support, and God bless.
And I'd like to remind everyone that, yes, what we do here is supported by your donations. Blog Talk Radio, we don't charge you anything to listen, and we don't get paid here on staff. I'm doing this in my own free time, so please support us. And if you want to support me personally, you can go to deeperwaters.wordpress.com. You can also let Mike and Debbie know that you want to support me through Risen Jesus, and you can support me through Ratio Christi Issues and Answers, and I'm sure this is something that Eric will definitely agree with me on, seeing as he's a director of a Ratio Christi chapter himself.
Yeah, if you really want to support a really a vibrant, growing apologetics movement, Ratio Christi is very relevant, and it's making a difference on college campuses. So we are up to, I believe, over 100 chapters now, and we've had plenty of speakers come into Ohio State, such as William Lane Craig, Frank Turek, Mike Lacona, Michael Brown. We do debates on these campuses. We do lectures. We do meetings. We do evangelism. We have debates, student debates. So we are making a difference, and it's a much-needed area today in our culture. We just can't afford to not have some sort of apologetics presence. And so Ratio Christi is making a difference. I encourage you to support Nick in that area.
And we also have going right now for Ratio Christi, don't know all the details entirely, but Rick Schenker, who runs it, said there's a $40,000 matching grant deal going on right now.
That's right. That's right. There is a matching grant, and you can go to the website. Just type in ratiochristi.org. It should all be on there right clear as day. So ratiochristi.org.
Now, we were talking some about messianic prophecies. One of the best works I've read on this lately has been The Lost World of Scripture by Sandy and Walton. And their view is that there is a certain teaching going on in Old Testament texts, and the New Testament writer finds a parallel situation in the New Testament times. It doesn't mean that that's what the Old Testament writer had in mind, but that the situation is parallel. And says, well, why don't we do this today? He says, it's because of an authority issue. We're not apostles, so we don't have the authority to pronounce this is a fulfillment going on right now.
Oh, it's very interesting. Nick, I have not read that book yet, but I'm about to, so you'd have to illuminate me a little more on what they're saying, because I can't speak to it. But I would say that it's interesting. I do agree that there are like parallel situations, if I understand what they're saying, in the Old Testament, that the New Testament's doing that. You know, they're taking a parallel situation and using that as a fulfillment, like in the life of Jesus. So, but one thing I just want to stress about Messianic prophecy is that, you know, we have to remember that when we're looking at the Messianic prophecies, as we talk about Jesus, we have to look at the Messianic names or titles for Jesus, that like Son of Man, Servant, Wonderful Counselor, Prince of Peace, the word branch. You know, these things are really important, because if we don't look at those texts, we're going to be kind of lost. And remember that we're not just looking for the word Messiah in the Old Testament, because obviously we're not going to find that word a lot. We're not going to find a text where it says the Messiah will do A, B, C, D, and E. It's just going to say, a text may say, look, the world looks different here, or like at the end of Zechariah 14 where this figure comes the Mount of Olives, right? It doesn't say the Messiah. It says he will come, you know, his feet will set down the Mount of Olives, and then we'll see the nations going back up the Feast of Tabernacles, worshiping, you know, this figure there. But so we have to be careful on that and do the proper exegesis. But I think Messianic prophecy is very important, because it does show a case of God working in history. Let's face it, with skeptics, Nick, you and I know, what do we always deal with? Well, give me an argument God exists. You know, I want proof. I want evidence. And one of the things I always ask is that, well, listen, if God's good, if there's really a good God, wouldn't he pick somewhere in history to reveal himself? Wouldn't he show up somewhere to show what he has for humanity? Wouldn't that make sense? And they're like, well, okay. So when we're talking about prophecy, we're talking about there is a place that we can look at and see where God worked, where he, you know, brought some things to pass that he promised, and they did come to pass in the person and work of Jesus. And, of course, you know, that's very important. So I think historical apologetics is very relevant, but we've got to get people to think through, even Jewish people who don't believe in God, to think about the God speaking somewhere in history. He's not just a deistic God, right? He's often distant.
If there were a few messianic prophecies you'd point to, since you said so many of them can be taken out of context, if there were a few that you would use, which ones would they be?
Yeah, well, I'd say a few that I think about that I think are kind of interesting to look at, that I think if I tied in a couple together, when you talk about like Genesis 49, 8 to 12, we're talking about the passage about the universal ruler that's going to come out of there, where Judah's about to die, and he prophesies about, you know, one of the, there'll be a future leader coming out. He says in Genesis 49, 8 to 12, he says, Judah, your brothers shall praise you, your hand shall be the neck of your enemies, your father's son shall bow down to you. He goes on to talk about the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from his feet, until Shiloh comes, and to him shall be the obedience of the peoples, or Shiloh, I'm sorry. So he talks about this future ruler coming out, and this figure will have like a worldwide dominion, he'll have the obedience of the peoples. And that is very interesting, because it really ties into the Daniel 7 passages I talked about, because that speaks about the Son of Man having a universal rule, that the nations will worship him, like all the nations and tribes will bow down to him. So I look at a couple of these passages as being, could really only be fulfilled by Jesus, because the scepter passage from Genesis 49 has like a timeline. It talks about how this issue of the scepter, like the word scepter is like a symbol of kingly authority. So basically it's saying they will remain in Judah's hand until Shiloh comes. Now the word Shiloh sometimes in Judaism is a name for the Messiah. So in the minds of Jewish people, scepter was kind of linked with this right to enforce the law of Moses upon the people, including like capital punishment. So what's saying this prophecy, it's saying this prophecy will say Judah will lose that tribal independence until the advent of the Messiah when he comes. And we know that when Jesus came, that the Sanhedrin did not have the power to enforce a capital sentence upon him. We know the Romans did it, right? And so that is kind of like a timeline about the coming of this universal ruler. And then, of course, it hasn't been totally fulfilled, because all the nations are not bowing down to Jesus. I mean, certainly there are people, a lot of people worship Jesus, but not, you know, in a physical sense. So That's a little bit in the future, too, and then Daniel 7 is another one. Let's think of another prophecy. It's a good one. Do you think Isaiah 53 has a lot of weight to it? But I think we just need to also understand that we have to make sure that understand Jews think that passage is about Israel. They do think that Israel is a suffering servant there. But I think if you break it down line by line, it it talks about this, you know, this servant that will, you know, suffer and die. He'll make atonement, and I think it's really hard to make that fit Israel. You know, that they were never totally righteous by any means, and so we know that that's hard. Another thing I think is a strong prophecy. Yeah, go ahead.
A passage that came to my mind actually was Daniel 9. Where you talk about the 70 weeks. That can get us into some eschatological difficulties, but from what I see, and even from my preterist interpretation, that it just pinpoints the time of Jesus perfectly.
Yeah, that's another good passage. One thing that I do think is an interesting prophecy is the Abrahamic covenant itself, is because when Abraham is called out and God forms that covenant with him, it says through his seed the nations will be blessed. So we see that Israel has this calling to the whole world. They're supposed to be a light to the nations. And when the Messiah comes, of course, he's supposed to help fulfill Israel's calling. That's why when Jesus in Matthew 10, he tells the disciples, only go to the lost sheep house of Israel. And he says in Matthew 15, he says, I was only sent to the lost sheep house of Israel. But then at the end of Matthew, of course, he has a commission to go to the nations. And we read in Isaiah 49 about the servant passage, Isaiah 49, 1 through 7, about the servant will be a light to the nations. And I just want to say, what are the chances of a crucified Jew in the first century being crucified, opening the door to millions of non-Jews to believe in the one true God? I mean, what are the chances of that happening, of all the messianic figures in Judaism, that this figure, Jesus, who was crucified by the Romans, who, you know, had a hard start, it's hard to start a new religion off a crucified Jew, you know, let alone, you know, then it turns out we have 1.4 billion non-Jews worshiping the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So that seems to be somewhat prophetic as well, you know, the Abrahamic covenant being fulfilled in Jesus, that we do have the nations worshiping the one true God. Now, some people may say, well, that's just big numbers. You're going by numbers. No, I'm talking about, what are the chances of the Messiah being rejected by his own people, being a Jew, of course, and then non-Jews believing? There's kind of like a specific part of that prophecy. You know, it's not just general by any means.
Yeah, and also I think when I look at the prophecies in Daniel again, like when you look at the second chapter about the kingdoms that will rise up and such, and then we tie it in with the timing in Daniel 9, it gives me the impression that if the Messiah did not come in the time of Jesus, he never is going to come.
That's right. I mean, Daniel certainly has some of the best timelines, and I think that when we tie that in with Genesis 49, I think those are very powerful. Now, the rabbis, there are some passages in the Talmud. Some of the rabbis forbid the Jewish people to try to guess the timing of the Messiah. There is some, you know, they say, you know, you can't know, you shouldn't try to figure it out. I think part of that is a response to the fact that the messianism has been a disappointment for them. They still haven't, you know, the Messiah hasn't come for them, and they've been let down because, you know, obviously the Davidic king hasn't come, and Israel has never been restored. Now, I know that gets into a lot of eschatology stuff, but it's interesting, you know, that they forbid their people to necessarily talk about the coming of the Messiah anymore. Right. I mean, somewhat.
Yeah. We can certainly be thankful that on the New Testament we don't have any sort of event that people are trying to guess the times of and make predictions of on our end. We are so blessed that we don't have that problem at all either.
Right, that's right. We have we don't have to worry about that. It's interesting also that in Judaism there is a saying or a tradition that they can hasten the coming of the Messiah, that they can, if they keep Torah, if Jews return to Torah and keep Torah, that actually their righteous living can hasten the coming of the Messiah, the first coming. And it's interesting, 2 Peter 3, where Peter talks about our holy living, how we can hasten the coming of the Messiah, the return of the Messiah. It means speed up. That's what that word means. The Greek word means to speed up, and that's done by our holy living as well. So that's a very interesting contrast, you know, that there is kind of some teaching on that in the New Testament as well, about hastening the return of the Messiah. So we need to get the church living righteously.
Yeah. If we go by the work of people like N.T. Wright, and I say, if you want to see the return of Christ, if you want to see God's kingdom on earth, then according to 2 Peter 3, what you need to do, live holy and righteous lives.
That's right. And, you know, the kingdom of God theme, I think, is really the main, I think that's really like the when talking about messianic prophecy, that is one of the key themes of understanding the whole Bible and prophecy, because it's really about the reign of God over the world. And when we talk about the coming king, you know, we believe Jesus is certainly the Davidic king. Jews think he's not the Messiah because he didn't do what the Davidic king's supposed to do. But we think it's broken up into a two-act play, and whereas they think that it's, you know, it certainly hasn't even happened at all yet. And that's a very interesting topic in itself.
Yeah, it just seems we've lost so much of the New Testament in our modern times that we focus so much on salvation by grace through faith and such, which is extremely important, not going to deny that. But we don't have hardly anything being taught about the kingdom of God in our churches when Jesus talked about it constantly.
Right, and I think that some of the scholars that have been writing on this, like Scott McKnight and others, you know, they want to return to kind of like, we think we should be preaching more of like a kingdom gospel, a king gospel, instead of just basically basing it on just a series of propositions to believe, you know, like a, you know, I have to believe Jesus died and rose from the dead, that's it, you know, propositionally. I think they want, Greg Boyd's written about this too, you know, they want to see more of a gospel preached, you know, asking people to come into the reign of God, this new way of living. You know, it's more holistic, it's much more bigger than simply believing a few propositional truths, right? So there's some merit to that, and, you know, I think that's okay to talk about. But the kingdom, reign of God thing, you have to study that. I mean, that's paramount to understanding the Bible. No doubt about it. We can't get around it at all. Nick, I was just going to mention that, you know, maybe we could also discuss a little bit some of the differences in Judaism and Christianity, like some of the basics, like what, you know, where do they part ways with us on just how we live, like how we live as Christians, you know, like the way they view us, maybe we view them, you know, some of those things,
I mean,
like the way we live our lives.
For instance, I know with most Orthodox Jews and such, when it came to moral issues, we could probably stand alongside them on several moral issues. I mean, there are people like Dennis Prager who are quite thankful for Christians in America today taking our stance that we have, but there are areas of difference, mainly on doctrinal ones, I think. But what are the main differences and main similarities you see?
Well, I think that for most Jews, you know, there's this old saying that Christians are about the creed and Jews are about the deed. That's kind of a saying they've always been taught. I think it, you know, I can see how they can see it because, let's face it, in Christianity we have a lot of systematic theology, we have a lot of denominations, we have all kinds of disagreements, doctrinal disagreements. We know there's plenty of those. And they kind of view us to be more about orthodoxy, be more about orthodoxy and orthopraxy. Orthodoxy is right belief, orthopraxy is right practice. So now my response to that is that, look, we can be perceived that way, but I do think that Christianity, we do care about orthopraxy. I mean, we do want orthodoxy to cause right living. We want it to lead to right living, right? So we don't try to divorce them. Now, we can come across that way, and that's our own fault, but our own faults for doing that, but we do believe orthopraxy is extremely important. But for Jews, overall, beliefs are not as important as practice. I mean, I've talked enough of them and dialogue with them that they think, just to know, they think very pragmatically. It's more about how you live. It's what you do. It's not as much about what you believe in, you know, believing the right things. And so that's one of the things that they view as a difference between us. Another issue is this issue of salvation. They do not view... So whereas Christians generally think of salvation as one category, as getting saved so you can go on to heaven when you die, that's just not even in the front of their thinking. There's nothing in there. There's not even in their thinking at all, really, salvation, being saved, you know, from eternal destruction. They don't really have that in their thinking. So I try to respond to that and say salvation is much broader in the Bible. Obviously, it's not just when you die. I mean, it starts today. It's, you know, it's more holistic. Those are a couple of things that stand out to me. Another one is tie that in with the afterlife. Most Jews don't believe in the afterlife. They don't think about it a lot. They don't really worry about it a lot. So, you know, our teachings to them, you need to believe in Jesus so you don't go to hell, is just kind of a foreign concept to them. So what I try to do with them is say, look, Jesus taught about eternal life, but eternal life starts today. It's in this life. It's a new way of life, and you can have shalom. You can have the peace of God in this life. Now, you can make a difference in this world. But, you know, if you're correctly related to God, that really helps, right? Because you have atonement for your sins. But it sure is that those are just some of the obstacles to get through with them. There are many more.
We're going to have to take another break right now. I'm Nick Peters of the Deeper Waters Podcast. We're going to be taking our final break. We'll be back to wrap things up.
Oh, yeah. Hey, folks, it's Will ZPI, and you guys got to check out CYIWorldwide.com, home of the Grok Show. Free MP3s, music, advice, and even prayer support. That again is CYIWorldwide.com. Check it out.
I'm Nick Peters with Deeper Waters Podcast. My guest today is Eric Chabot. We're talking about Jesus in Judaism. We're talking about things that unite us, things that divide us. And what fascinates me so much is that Jesus really is such a major dividing point between Jews and Christians. I've found it incredible that you can be a Jew and deny that Yahweh even exists, and hey, that's A-okay, you're still one of us. You're a Jew and you believe Jesus is the Messiah, you've abandoned your heritage, get out.
That's right. Well, that's true, but it's interesting, the latest Pew survey that I talked about earlier, where I talked about Jews not needing to believe in God and still being Jewish, 32% of Jews now in America today now believe you can believe in Jesus and be a Jew. That's 32%. Now, that's up a little bit from what it used to be. But now when it comes to the Orthodox community, I would say that definitely believe in Jesus is a no-no, and you can't be Jewish. I would say Reformed Jews probably don't care that much. They're probably a little more tolerant of it. And I would say Conservative Jews a little bit in between. But you're right that a lot of Jews just think that Jesus has nothing to do with Jewish identity. And you can be an atheist and be culturally Jewish, and you're still Jewish. So it shows you the disconnect there. It's very interesting. It's sad, too. But my Jewish friends have come to faith in Jesus. In all honesty, they're actually, some of them are even more observant now. I mean, just their Jewish culture and lifestyle than they were before they came to faith in Jesus. I mean, they maintain more of a Jewish identity than they did before. Because they want to be a testimony to their own people, and they want to say, hey, I can be a Jew and believe in Jesus and maintain a Jewish identity, and there's nothing wrong with it. So, you know, that's very interesting.
A lot of Christians could probably benefit by really being around some Jews and seeing the ceremonies that they go through and such. I remember being on Power Talk one time and having someone on there who was rabbi and a Messianic Jew, and he took us for video through a Passover service and all the Jewish rituals that they went through, and it was an extremely fascinating experience.
Right. Yeah, and I've done some Passovers in churches. There's a lot of interest in that. Yeah, it's very helpful to kind of connect the both testaments and see how the holidays or the feasts, you know, in the Old Testament are fulfilled in the person of Jesus, such as Passover or the Feast of Tabernacles, like in John chapter 7, you know, that's the background of John chapter 7. Then you have even Hanukkah as the background of John chapter 10. That's a feast of dedication, you know, where Jesus is teaching there. So a lot of these things can be, are very meaningful, and they can help Christians kind of have a deeper, fuller understanding of the relationship between both testaments. And I find most Christians walk away with their eyes open. They're like, wow, that's really cool. So it is needed, and I think Christians can benefit from it. It's not, you know, certainly not saying it's, if they don't get it, it's going to be the worst thing in the world, but it certainly helps a lot to understand their faith.
Yeah, and part of our problem sometimes in Christian studies is that we can go to the New Testament and say, ah, this is central, this is important. The Old Testament, well, we study that, but we study it to see what it really says about Jesus. And one of the things we really need to be doing more is trying to read the Old Testament like a Jew, and not just a Jew, but a Jew living before Jesus and saying, if I was a Jew living at, say, the time of Moses, and I was reading the Pentateuch, what would I be getting out of it? And that
exactly.
Yes.
Yeah, I agree 100% because, you know, a lot of Christians, I mean, I've taught some classes on Jewish roots of Christianity and just some basics, and a lot of Christians tell me, look, I was just taught the Old Testament's irrelevant. You know, Jesus comes, we got to get people in the New Testament, the New is what's important, and they just begin to just kind of disregard a lot of the Old Testament. They think it's, you know, it's about law versus grace. They think it's about, you know, Jesus is the fulfillment, the Old Testament's irrelevant. And that's just a tragedy because you really miss the continuity between both Testaments. And you miss the book that Jesus read growing up and that Paul read. I mean, there was no New Testament at their time. So, you know, it's really sad that we would even teach that to people in churches or in seminary. And, you know, we just can't afford to do that. So we need a fuller understanding to read both Testaments together and quit looking at them as like a Marcion. Take Marcion, you know, he was one of the culprits of that, right? Thinking a lot of the Old Testament was bad. So we need to get both Testaments together. It's very important.
Not only is it the book Jesus read, it's the book that, not only is it the book that Paul read, it was in fact the Bible of the early church. They didn't have a New Testament they were walking around with after Jesus rose again. They had the Old Testament. That was their scripture. And when you read Paul's epistles, he quotes from it to Gentiles profusely, which means even by this point, Gentiles had learned their Old Testament very, very well, which would mean it had to be being taught regularly in their churches.
That's right. And we do know that they use the Septuagint a lot, which is the Greek translation of the Old Testament. That was one of the main, you know, the texts they used for a lot of those prophecies and other things. So we need to have, I think, you know, Philip Yancey wrote a book called The Book Jesus Read. I think it was a book, basically, you know, his awakening to the Old Testament. You know, he went back and read the Old Testament and realized, you know, this is the book that Jesus read growing up and how ignorant I am as a Christian of the Old Testament. Even to call it Old Testament could be problematic, right? Because you say that to some people, it kind of always sounds like it's a little inferior. You know, it's kind of like, that's Old Testament. You know, many Christians say that to me. They say, that's Old Testament. We got the New Testament, right? And so we may even want to rethink some of our vocabulary. Like one of the books by Daryl Bach I have on, it's called Jesus the Messiah. It's a book on Messianic prophecy he co-wrote with a couple other authors. They call it the First Testament and the Second Testament. That's the terminology they're using in their book. They're getting away from old and new. So isn't that kind of interesting, right?
Yeah, I remember sometimes I used to listen to Steve Brown talk on Key Life, and he talked about the Older Testament and the Old Testament.
Right. So we need to think about some of the terminology we use and just think about what that communicates to people when we're teaching and writing, you know, what, because I run into so many Christians that, I mean, I've done this for a while with the Jewish stuff, and, you know, they just will always say, well, that's Old Testament. You know, we got to get people in the New Testament. And, you know, I was like, well, wait a minute. I mean, what book was it that Jesus and Paul read? And you'd be surprised how many of them just don't even know that. So that's something we got to work on. So we got our work cut out for us.
Now, what do you think really the main stumbling blocks today keeping Jews from recognizing Jesus as their Messiah? When you point out, yes, he is their Messiah.
Yeah, well, I think that it's several issues. I think that Paul, a good reading of Romans, will help clarify a lot of those issues. Whenever I get discouraged in Jewish missions, I just go back and read Romans over and over. But, you know, Paul talks about how they have a zeal for God, but not according to knowledge. You know, Romans 10, I think he says that, you know, that some Jews, at least Orthodox Jews, believe in God. They're trying to still work on Torah, you know, as far as getting right with God. But I'd say probably some of the main stumbling blocks are misunderstandings, a reaction to Christianity. It's been a reaction to what Christianity's been through the centuries to them. They are told over and over that, you know, it is a kind of a pagan thing, you know, to believe in Jesus and the Trinity. So And part of it's reaction to anti-Semitism as a stumbling block. Part of it is just not even seeing Jesus in Jewish context at all. I mean, many Jews don't think there's really anything about Jesus that is Jewish. They just think it's the Christian religion, and we've got nothing to do with that because we're Jews. So they view them as just totally opposites of each other, and so a lot of it's education. But I say just to anybody else, every Jew comes to faith the same way any Gentile does. They have to be seeking. God has to draw them, and they have to be willing to look into it. Guys like Michael Brown and other Messianic Jews have all gone down that road, and they were open to research it themselves. They didn't necessarily just believe what the rabbi said. They, you know, took the time and investigated it, and God drew them in. So the last thing I'll say is that, remember, always there's a remnant who believes. It's always been a remnant. It's never been the, you know, all the Jews have always believed, right? It's always been a remnant that believed in the one true God, a remnant that believed in the Messiah in the first century. That's like it's a remnant today. There's only a remnant who believes, and that's the way it's always been. But, of course, I believe that there'll be a stronger, there'll be a larger group of Jews coming to faith in the end times, because I think, like Paul talks about that, Romans 11, you know, what he means by all Israel will be saved. And some commentators, whether you're preterist, partial preterist or not, or whatever, if you want to be reformed in your theology, whatever your eschatology is, most still think, you know, there's going to be some sort of work. You know, God's going to do something with Israel. It'll be hard to say in Romans 9 through 11 there's not something there that's going to take place in the future. I don't, you know, completely understand how it's all going to take place, but something will happen, you know, at some stage. So that's what we pray for until then.
Yeah. So, something anyway. Else that, something else I think that would keep the Jews away sometimes is, now, I'm not saying Judaism is a cult, of course not, but when you talk with people who are Mormons, Jehovah's Witnesses, one of the things you have to realize is that if they leave Mormonism or the Watchtower, they are pretty much leaving everything, and that includes abandoning their family, their job, their friends, etc. And there could be some Jews also up there who think they are abandoning their heritage if they believe in Jesus, and they are being untrue to their family, their ancestors, etc.
Well, that's exactly right. That's a huge stumbling block. That's probably the top thing, I would say, the biggest issue of all, because, like I said, most Jews will say, look, I was born a Jew, I'll die a Jew. So, and they do lose their whole families. I mean, Orthodox Jews who come to faith in Jesus, or even conservative Jews, have been written off by their families. Some Orthodox fathers will say to their sons or daughters, you're dead to me now. You're no longer my child. So that does happen. Now, they don't get killed like in Muslim countries if you come to faith, but, you know, they do get rejected by their whole community and families, and that's something that they think about, obviously. It weighs heavily on their heart. You know, they're going to get rejected. I find that most Reformed Jews, if you come to faith in Jesus, you know, they're not going to take it as hard. I mean, they may not be wild about it, but they're not going to disown you necessarily because they're a little more tolerant and liberal in some things. But when it comes to Orthodox Jews, it's a big deal. I know Michael Brown told me a story of a guy that came to faith in Jesus, a friend of his, or a guy he was witnessing to or mentoring. And this guy, apparently he was in some part of the U.S. He flew overseas to see Michael in another part of the world where Michael was doing ministry, and somebody came out when he was in the hotel. He was waiting for Michael. A group of Orthodox Jews pulled up in a car and took this guy, kidnapped him, and drove away. His parents basically sent people to get him away, you know, from being influenced by, you know, Christians or Messianic Jews. So they don't mess around with that stuff. You know, it's very serious. You're right. It is like heresy. It's totally departing from your heritage.
Now, you've talked about Michael Brown before, and he is one of the leading Messianic Jews today. Can you name any other Messianic Jews who could have, like, websites and books that people could go and check and get some more information from?
Sure. There's a website called The Return of the Kosher Pig. It's called The Return of the Kosher Pig. That's the name of the website. It's a book that has been written by another Messianic Jew by the name of... he's actually Israeli, but he lives in Texas. But the guy that wrote it, his name is his last name is Shapira, and he was born and raised in a Sephardic Jewish home in Israel. So what he did, he wrote this book called The Return of the Kosher Pig, and basically what he's doing is he's taking the rabbinic Jewish texts, the ones the rabbis read, you know, the stuff in the Talmud and elsewhere, and he's using the Old Testament, And he's basically making a case for why Jesus is the divine Messiah. That's kind of a newer work that's come out over the last 6 to 8 months, and it's causing quite a stir in the Jewish community. Michael knows all about it. Michael Brown knows all about it. I encourage maybe Christians to read that. It's been endorsed by a couple Christian scholars, and of course Michael's endorsed it, but it's very controversial, and that would be the other book I would go to, written by a Messianic Jew that's got, you know, using the literature really to talk about why Jesus is the divine Messiah, and it's using the rabbinical literature as well. So, Return of the Kosher Pig, that's the name of the website.
How about Jews for Jesus as well?
Jews for Jesus does good work. You can go on their website. I really can't think of any particular scholar out of them that, you know, has done anything, really something like a major work. But, yeah, Jews for Jesus is another website. You can go to Chosen People Ministries. Chosen People Ministries is another one. They're another website. You could look up, you could go to Michael, anywhere on YouTube. There's a guy named Michael Redelnik. He teaches at Moody Bible Institute. He's in charge of the Jewish Studies program there. He's a Messianic Jewish believer who's done some good scholarship. Michael Redelnik is another one. I'm trying to get some other ones. I can't think of them all right now, but that should get you going. That's for sure, those right there, those websites. That should give you enough to start with, including Michael Brown's called Ask Dr. Brown. You know, that's his website.
Eric, we've only got about 5 minutes left or so, and I'm sure there could be some people out there who have many, many more questions, and you're always open to questions on this sort of topic. If people want to get in touch with you, what can they do?
Well, you can go to my blog. My personal blog is called thinkapologetics.com, thinkapologetics.com. I do have a section there on answering Jewish objections to Jesus. You'll look in the tab bar and the titles at the top. There is a section there. I've put a lot of resources on there. I don't only focus on that on my blog, but certainly a large part of it. So you go to my blog, thinkapologetics.com. My contact info is on there. If you just go to the contact tab, my email is there. You can email me or contact me on the blog. I'm not hard to find at all. So, or you go to the Ratio Christi website as well. I'm on there with our Ohio State blog. So not hard to find.
Mm-hmm. And now we've got a little bit over 4 minutes left, so it gives you some good time. Give us a final message you'd like to give to Jews and to Christians as well, and maybe how this could tie in with the Christmas season coming up.
Okay. Well, I think that we know that Jesus is the dividing point between Christianity and Judaism, but for my Christian friends, I encourage you to really think about, you know, why we even focus on Christmas this time of year. I know that many of us know the commercial aspects of it. There's nothing to do with the Bible. It has nothing to do with the Bible. But as far as just the issue of Jesus, I just would ask you to take a closer look at the deity of Jesus and really think about studying more of the Old Testament and finding out, digging deeper about his deity and asking who he is and wrestling with his identity. And I encourage you also to contact and get in touch with some of these Jewish sources that we've talked about on this show. You know, your faith can be so much richer and so much fuller if you would kind of link both testaments together and go into some of the Jewish sources. And like Nick said about the book that he was reading, understand how a Jew at the time of Jesus would have viewed Jesus. How would a Jew at that time period view Jesus as claiming to be the temple in person or crucified Messiah? What would it be like on the ground at that time? Try to get in their shoes and their thinking at that time and study that issue. And then also focus on study some of the prophecies, do a deeper study on Messianic prophecy and really find out what are really good prophecies to use and, you know, get the full context of those passages in the Old Testament. Don't do a superficial study on that. Now, for Jewish people, I would just say that I would hope that you would take a closer look at Jesus and at least take the time to examine his claims and think about who he is, because, you know, let's face it, if he really is who he is, if he really is the Messiah, really the one who came as a Jewish Messiah, as a Davidic king, it's true or it's not true. Objectively, he either is or he isn't, no matter how we feel about it, no matter how our emotions are, we have to realize it's either true or it's not true. We owe it to ourselves to examine who he is. And if he is who he is, think about this. You've been going to Yom Kippur or Rosh Hashanah, going through the high holiday services in the fall. You can know for sure that you have atonement for sins. You can know you can have the shalom of God, have forgiveness, and know that you're correctly related to the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And we all long to know God, so I hope that you look closer at the claims of Jesus and not just reject it based on what you've been told. Examine his deity. Ask, is there really a case for the deity of Messiah? Is it just something that's impossible to happen? Is it, you know, out of the ordinary, or is there a case in the Bible for the deity of the Messiah? And so having said that, I hope that we can learn from each other. Christians and Jews can learn from one another and listen to one another in dialogue, and hopefully build bridges as the years come to pass.
Okay, well, we got to wrap up. One more people next week, Anthony McRoy talking about Christmas traditions. Now, I'm Nick Peters, signing off of the Deeper Waters podcast, thanking Eric Chabot for being my guest.